stories, big guests, the big picture. Afternoons with Rob Breckenridge. Weekdays 1230 to 3, 770 CHQR.
All right, welcome to this hour of the program. Rob Breckenridge with you on this Friday afternoon. Plenty more still to come this afternoon. We will hear at 3:30, as mentioned, from Alberta's Chief Medical Officer of Health and a few other topics to get to between now and then. This Sunday marks 57 years since, you know, certainly one of the biggest events of the 21st century, the assassination of U.S. President John F. Kennedy, 11-22-63. So it was obviously a huge event. People who were born long after are well aware of it. I mean, one of the reasons why there's still fascination with it, though, of course, is not just that a sitting president was shot to death, but just all of the conspiracy theories around it. You know, that there were other forces at play here, other agendas at play here. And, you know, the idea that there was a secret conspiracy, it certainly, I think, has prolonged the fascination. And it's still very much alive today. That somebody other than, or including, I guess, Lee Harvey Oswald was responsible for what happened. And we've spoken before with our next guest. In fact, he wrote a book a couple of years ago on his own early infatuation with some of these conspiracy theories before eventually coming around to the view that indeed Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. So he's got a long-standing interest in this topic. His latest book is called On the Trail of Delusion, Jim Garrison, the Great Accuser. Joining us to talk more about the assassination, the conspiracy theories, and this new book. You can read more, by the way, at the website onthetrailofdelusion.com. Fred Litwin joins us on the line here this afternoon. Fred, great to have you back with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
I hope you're doing well. Congrats on the new book.
Thank you.
So let's talk about what led you to this specific aspect of the story. There's a lot to the JFK story, as you well know. I guess people who have seen the Oliver Stone movie have a good idea of who Jim Garrison is. But let's talk about why you wanted to explore this topic in particular.
Well, it's an absolutely incredible story. It's a story of an innocent gay man, Clay Shaw, who was charged with conspiracy to kill Kennedy in 1967 by the District Attorney of New Orleans, Jim Garrison. And it took 2 years to come to trial. Shaw was then acquitted, and then Garrison charged him with perjury. It took 2 years for him to get that charge quashed, and then he got ill and died of cancer with most of his life savings gone. It's a tragic story, and I told the story in my last book, but what I wanted to do in this book was I traveled around to every archive in the United States that had primary Jim Garrison documents. And I told not only this story, but other stories of other people he went after. And I provide a lot of primary documents so that people can see exactly what happened.
So let's take it back to the beginning. So as you mentioned, so Jim Garrison is a district attorney in Orleans Parish in Louisiana. So obviously the assassination took place in Dallas. So this not necessarily in his jurisdiction. But how does he then insert himself? How does he become a part of this story here?
Well, Lee Harvey Oswald lived in New Orleans for 5 months prior to the assassination. And in fact, there were two leads in New Orleans that Garrison investigated back in 1963 with the FBI. And so when there was all this conspiracy fever in the fall of 1966, Garrison got caught up in it and he thought, you know what, let me go back to those leads back from 1963 and reinvestigate them and maybe I could find something. And he went back and looked at those leads, and nothing really happened, and he ended up, unfortunately, manufacturing evidence.
Why would he do that? Was it just then at this point about, you know, his own profile, trying to make himself famous? Was he just so hell-bent on going after Clay Shaw or trying to prove something? What's your sense of what motivated him at that point?
Well, he was a man of tremendous ambition. He really wanted to be senator or governor of Louisiana. He had gone after everybody in New Orleans, from judges to the mayor to the police, as political targets. Nobody was left, actually. Even the governor of Louisiana was scared of him. And so when he went down the assassination rabbit hole, one of his suspects unfortunately died of natural causes. And his staff at that point, this was early on in the investigation, his staff said, you know, you can quit now. You can hang your shoes up, say you investigated as far as you can, nothing happened, and you'll be a hero. But Garrison thought it was the crime of the century and that he could solve it. And unfortunately, he just never stopped, and he ended up ruining a lot of people's lives, manufacturing evidence, intimidating and bribing witnesses.
Yeah, and it's kind of an ugly manifestation of you know, this kind of belief in conspiracy, right? It's one thing to not accept the official version of events, to insist that it must have gone down a different way, but you know, it's one thing to have those beliefs. It's quite another to go about it this way and just sort of take a wrecking ball to so many people's lives.
Yeah, you know, it's fun if you believe in the Loch Ness Monster or Sasquatch or you have an interest in UFOs. I don't care if you believe in a conspiracy in JFK, but he went after real-life people, and he made their lives miserable. I mean, besides ruining Clay Shaw's life, and Clay Shaw was a World War II hero who just wanted to retire and write plays, and his life was ruined. But he went after other people, like Carlos Bringier was an anti-Castro Cuban. Garrison went after him, and his wife was so worried about him being arrested that she had a miscarriage. And there's just lots of stories like that. And in Garrison's wake, he left a lot of ruined lives.
Let's talk about Clay Shaw. You know, not only so did he find himself in the crosshairs of Garrison's crusade, but his sexual orientation was very relevant to the story, right? So it's not just an aside. It's not just, oh, by the way, Clay Shaw also happened to be gay. But this was something that Garrison really made a point of going after.
Yeah, Garrison was looking for this Mr. Clay Bertrand, who had tried to hire a lawyer in New Orleans to represent Lee Harvey Oswald. And Clay Bertrand, who nobody knew who it was, but he was gay, he spoke Spanish, and Garrison had this belief that, well, Clay Shaw was gay, Clay Shaw spoke Spanish, and he believed that gay people, when using a pseudonym, keep the same first name. So he believed that Clay Shaw was this mysterious Clay Bertrand. And on the basis, he had no evidence. But he ended up with one witness who he administered truth serum, hypnotized three times to recover a memory that Shaw was at a party where they discussed the assassination. And that was enough to have him arrested. And of course, as you say, initially, Garrison thought it was a homosexual conspiracy.
Right. So it was another way in which, and look, obviously at that time and in Louisiana, to be really emphasizing this and making a big deal of this aspect of the story was just another way of just kind of publicly humiliating, basically, wasn't it, Clay Shaw, and really trying to demolish his reputation.
Yeah, well, Clay Shaw was in the closet. His close friends, of course, knew he was gay, but it was Deep South. Even though it was New Orleans, it was still somewhat taboo to be openly gay. And in fact, Shaw never really wanted this to be discussed at all. And Garrison brought this out, and it made Clay Shaw very, very vulnerable because it made it hard to defend himself, and it also made a lot of his friends very, very, very nervous about whether they would be named in this probe as well.
So one would think that if Hollywood were going to sink its hooks into this story, that it would be about the persecution of a gay man. It would be about the victimization of Clay Shaw. Yet somehow, Oliver Stone made a movie that made Jim Garrison a hero. So how did that happen?
I've always said somebody should make a movie. It's really unbelievable. I mean, Oliver Stone decided he had to make a movie about the JFK assassination, and unfortunately has his vehicle to tell the story. He chose Jim Garrison. He optioned Garrison's book, paid him $250,000, and made Garrison the hero, and he turned Clay Shaw into a horrible, ugly villain played by Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah,
Clay Shaw was victimized the second time.
Yeah, he really was, and yeah, and I mean, Tommy Lee Jones took the role. Kevin Costner jumped into films. I mean, it's a lot of the blame maybe rests with Oliver Stone, but everybody else was more than happy to get on board with this project.
Yeah, and you look at the way Tommy Lee Jones played it. I mean, you just have to, you know, 5 minutes of looking at the way it was played, you knew that Clay Shaw was guilty. I mean, he really played him up as an evil person, and it was really horrible. It's an appalling thing that Oliver Stone did.
Now, I'm I'm not totally sure on the time. Was Jim Garrison still alive when that movie came out? I think he died around
Jim
that
Garrison
time.
Jim Garrison was in the movie.
Oh, was
Jim
he?
Jim Garrison
okay.
had a cameo role playing Earl Warren.
Oh, really? How ironic.
And unfortunately, Garrison died right after the movie came out. So he was very sick when that happened.
Okay. All right. So between the whole hubbub of the original Glashan trial, so this is now the late 60s, I think 69 was the trial, and then early 90s then when the movie comes out. Did Jim Garrison, I mean, did he kind of fade then into the background? What happened to him after the trial and in the 70s and 80s?
Well, after the trial, he wrote a book called The Heritage of Stone, which blamed the assassination on the CIA. He didn't mention Glashan because there were still appeals in place. And then, of course, he went back and tried to convince the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1976 and 77 that he had all these great leads. And every single lead that he gave them to investigate, this was the famous second investigation, none of Garrison's leads turned out. And so his only option after that was to write his book, which, of course, he had pay dirt with Oliver Stone. So he was lucky at the end. He finally hit the big time.
So he was a figure of some profile, some notoriety, and, you know, certainly had what would seem to people like a credible argument that he's a district attorney and he's trying to solve a crime. So do you think that he was influential in persuading people that there really was a conspiracy? What do you see as his role in advancing and keeping those conspiracy theories going?
I think he was greatly influential because he crisscrossed the United States talking about conspiracy, talking about the CIA and the military-industrial complex, and he was very influential. You know, you could just see he was everywhere, and his books sold quite well, and a lot of people went from there and took his arguments further. So he was very influential, unfortunately.
And absent the movie, maybe he would have kind of faded into history. Certainly the movie gave him and his reputation and everything that preceded it. It certainly breathed new life into all of that, didn't it?
Oh, it really did. I mean, after the movie, the paperback edition of his book came out. Warner Brothers paid him $140,000 for the paperback rights. And, of course, the hardcover still sold. I mean, it was a huge seller. It was the start of a huge amount of interest. I mean, the film grossed $210 million. It was a huge hit at the time. It was absolutely amazing. And, of course, on DVD, people are still today buying the DVD or the Blu-ray set of Oliver Stone's film. It still sells.
Which I think speaks to the broader phenomenon that there just still is a real fascination, isn't it? And I remember, you know, to me, I'm fascinated with this. I remember reading and devouring Stephen King's book a few years ago.
Yeah, so did I.
This, you know, and I was looking forward to this conversation, too, for the exact same reason. It is a fascinating story. People are still, you know, people who were born long after it, very much still fascinated with it. Why do you think that is?
It's the ultimate of conspiracy theories. So this is the Rosetta Stone of conspiracy theories. It explains everything. And for a lot of people, it allows you to use the JFK assassination to explain geopolitical events today. If you don't like the CIA, you could say, well, it's all because of the JFK assassination. If you don't like American foreign policy, you could say it was because of the assassination, everything changed. So it allows you to use the assassination in a variety of ways to explain your current political beliefs.
Well, the book is called On the Trail of Delusion, Jim Garrison, the Great Accuser. Much more at onthetrailofdelusion.com. Fred, it's been great talking to you here again today. Thanks so much for making some time for us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
All the best. That is Fred Litwin. His latest book is called On the Trail of Delusion, onthetrailofdelusion.com. Also, his previous book, I Was a Teenage JFK Conspiracy Freak. So he's long been fascinated with this, like a lot of people, and sort of went from believing that, yeah, maybe there really was a conspiracy to ultimately, no, it doesn't look like there was, actually. But certainly, the story of Jim Garrison and what happened to Glashan is a story that deserves some specific attention in all of this. And so it's explored in Fred's new book. Welcome back. Rob Breckenridge with you. So as mentioned, we'll hear from Alberta's Chief Medical Officer of Health on the situation here in Alberta. It doesn't sound like the Alberta government's going to be releasing any new modeling numbers, but it's pretty clear we're on a worrying trajectory. We did see some new data released by the federal government earlier today, which suggests that really the country as a whole is on a dangerous path here, and that we got to figure out how to mitigate a lot of this. Now, I think, unfortunately, we've kind of backed ourselves into a corner where maybe further restrictions, lockdown measures might be our only option. But what about the strategy that really, you know, has been emphasized throughout this whole pandemic, is to try to stay a step ahead of the virus? A surveillance approach, test, trace, isolate. And, you know, and let's be honest, Alberta did have some success on that front. For certainly large parts of this whole situation. It's kind of fallen off the rails at the moment, though, unfortunately. Contact tracing in Alberta is a real mess for now. But when it comes to testing and approving new testing devices, obtaining new testing devices, that falls to the federal government. And so there's some frustration maybe that we haven't been as nimble on this as we should be in making sure that we have lots of options so that we can do the amount of testing that's necessary, and we can stay a step ahead of this. We seem to be getting closer to the point of having at-home testing as an option. And so what more do we need to do to make sure that that's something that we can incorporate into our response? So joining us for some further thoughts on some of these questions, very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, certainly someone with some insight on all of this. Joining us on the line here this afternoon is Dr. Prabhat Jha, epidemiologist at the University of Toronto, director of the Center for Global Health Research at St. Michael's Hospital. Dr. Jha, great to have you with us here this afternoon. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rob. Nice to be with you.
Let me get your thoughts, first of all, just in terms of, you know, the situation in Canada at the moment, worrying trends in terms of case growth, positive rate growth, hospitalization growth, increases in deaths. It's right across the board. It doesn't seem to be a very good situation.
I think you nailed it right in your introduction that we've backed ourselves in a corner, because in the summer, when cases were down and deaths were few, we should have been preparing for a fall wave by really ramping up testing, making sure that we got the home testing options available, and preparing for a tough fall. Now, I think all governments just let their guard down at the federal and provincial level. So now we're playing catch up, and it's much harder to do when you have a lot more infection circulating in the community, is to implement those strategies of test, contact tracing, and isolation. But it's still not too late to do so. I think it really should be done on almost a war footing as quickly as possible.
Help us understand, you know, we hear a lot about test, trace, isolate, and I think people understand the basics of what that is, but why, when done right, is that such an effective strategy?
Well, there's two things. One is we've got now a good understanding of the virus and how it transmits. So remember early on, we were so concerned that, you know, you pick it up from surfaces and grocery bags and so forth. It just ended up not being true. It's close contacts, and mostly contacts within a house and in indoor settings with basically poor ventilation and prolonged exposure. So we know that. So that means, very simply, if I'm infected in my house, and I know almost certainly that my family would get infected, but the other part that we now know is that basically after 9 days, the virus will die. So you take 2 weeks as kind of a safety buffer, and if I got infected, I locked my family down and I was in my house, then the worst would be some of us would get infected, but the infection wouldn't spread from our house. So it's a very simple principle that can be applied to control the epidemic. But what you need to know is to get the testing part right. We were supposed to be at a level of testing about 200,000 people a day in Canada, and we're nowhere near that. That was an aspiration that was set out, but we're nowhere near that. All the provinces are lagging behind their relative quotas. So this is where home testing might well have an important role. And again, I believe that Health Canada has been too slow to approve and review the home testing kits. I mean, they are being widely used in other parts of the world. And the basic principle of it is pretty simple. Is first, you have to trust Canadians, which one of the early reviews said, oh, we won't be able to, the Canadians won't be able to use this, right? I think that's a bit paternalistic. If you have, most Canadians are responsible, and if they had a home test, then I think they would follow those procedures. Test, if you're positive, isolate, and keep your family isolated. Now, if you get really sick, of course you have to go to the hospital, but for the vast majority of cases, it's, we're really talking about that scenario.
Yeah, one of the concerns, like obviously any new testing device has to be reviewed and approved by Health Canada. There's a process there. But we've also set a standard, which has been a bit of a barrier, the idea that any test that gets approved in Canada has to have a certain threshold, a certain sensitivity. And maybe it's a case of letting perfect be the enemy of the good. How has that gotten in the way of all of this?
It really isn't a big concern, because if most of the concerns would be that you get false positives, that basically you light up saying, okay, I actually have not been infected, or I have been infected, or the test shows I've been infected, whereas in fact I've been not. So the approach for that would be reasonably simple. Do another test. Or, meaning repeat the test, or go in and get a test at the confirmatory lab, meaning through the provinces. And I think there's an important piece that we've also not done enough, which is to get the contact tracing apps enabled so that you can actually report a home test. So now think about this. The federal COVID tracing app is actually quite good. And it's completely anonymous. You know, no one's getting that information except the person who has the phone. It, you know, it works by Bluetooth, so that if I enter into my phone, I've been tested positive, then it'll know from the Bluetooth history whoever I've been in contact with, and just send them a note saying you were exposed to somebody who tested positive. Doesn't tell you who, doesn't tell any details of the person, then that's an incentive for me to go get tested. So I think getting the federal contact tracing adapted, or this app adapted, to enable home test results to be entered and verified. You know, that's a very simple thing. Right now you enter a provincial number with your test result, because they don't want quacks to enter in all sorts of stuff. But this can be modified. You take a picture which has your confirmed test, so, and it's verifiable in a sense, and you know, just make it a crime to report tests or basically false tests or prank tests. Just make it a crime that you can potentially crack down on. And if we made the app also work on older phones, then you have a lot more people being able to control their decisions intelligently. And I do trust Canadians. I think most Canadians would do that. If I'm in a household, and let's say I have to go to work for my research purposes, so I take the public transport and go down to my office and use masks and all of those things. But so I'm slightly higher risk, but nothing like if I were a frontline nursing staff or a teacher, or if I was working in a long-term care home. But if I was in any of those really high-risk jobs, what would I do? Well, I test myself regularly, maybe twice a week. And if I'm positive, I basically lock down my house and say we're all going to stay put and others can be tested. And if enough people did that, you would be able to give them a tool where if they are going out and doing essential work, like teachers, for example, then they at least have the surety that they've been tested regularly and they're not spreading infection. So we haven't got this right. We blew the summer away, and but this is the time to now quickly catch up, be innovative, and I believe trust Canadians to do the right thing, and I think most will.
Yeah, and I think, again, you know, we're zeroed in on the short term here and you know, how we get a handle on things in the coming weeks here. But you know, we're going to be dealing with this for some months yet to come. And even once we have a vaccine widely available, you know, to have widely available tests as a backstop is probably advisable. So, you know, we've still got a long time that we're going to have to deal with this. So, as you said earlier, right, it's really not too late. And it's probably long past time that we prioritize this so that we can get ahead of this as quickly as possible.
That's right. You want to go into a battle with all the tools you can. So, of course, we have masks, and making masks pretty much mandatory for kind of any indoor setting is a good, indoor public setting is a good idea. We should have better tracing. And then if you think about the short term priorities, we clearly are concerned about protecting nursing homes, but nursing home staff, who have been the main source of infections, right now the testing is not mandatory, and it tends to be every couple of weeks at best. Nursing home staff should be tested twice a week, and a home test would actually fill that gap. And if you think about other key areas that we want to protect, certainly nursing homes are one, healthcare providers are another, teachers, so we can keep our schools open, and frontline workers, grocery clerks, so forth. So it wouldn't be hard to identify a high yield population in which you'd want to get them to encourage testing, and basically trust them to do so, report their results at least into the app so that others that they know will be notified. And as we think about the vaccine, remember, we can't bank on a vaccine as the end of this pandemic, because the number of doses that will be available in the medium term is going to be reasonably limited. Yeah. And those doses will be for exactly the highest risk populations, the people in nursing homes. That's the most important, I believe, so we don't have our elders dying or suffering in nursing homes. All the nursing home staffs, frontline hospital staff, those would be the priorities for any vaccine. And for the rest of us, we'll have to carry on using physical distancing, masks, and if we had testing and contact tracing, and I believe you should have the contact tracing set up, but the government cannot just do it on its own. So that's why you turn to Canadians to do self-test and self-isolation. There's a fourth piece of that, which is you really need to communicate this clearly. The public health officials have to clearly communicate, saying what is the expectations and what do we want people to do, and bring people along. Right now, we're spending way too much time talking about, oh, is the only solution to this a lockdown? And I think that's going to be more harmful than not. We need to do the things that work before we move to a lockdown.
Yeah, well said. We'll leave it there. Dr. Jha, thank you so much for making some time for us here today. Really appreciate your insight on all this.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. That is Dr. Prabhat Jha joining us from Toronto, epidemiologist, health economist, founding director of the Center for Global Health Research at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto at the University of Toronto. And his thoughts on why, you know, we got to make this a much bigger priority than it is. We need to take a break here, though. Plenty more still to come. My name is Rob Breckenridge. We're back with more right after this. All right, welcome back. Rob Breckenridge with you on the Chorus Radio Network. It's certainly that time of year, and going to be that time of year when folks start heading out in the backcountry, whether it be skiing or snowmobiling or climbing, cross-country skiing, all kinds of different activities. And maybe more so this year, with a lot of other travel options being limited, you know, like we saw in the summer with folks getting out and camping and enjoying the backcountry, we may see a lot of that this winter. So with that in mind, the Association for Canadian Mountain Guides launched a new Backcountry Safe initiative. You can go to backcountrysafe.ca. There's a lot of resources there on what folks need to know before they head out into the backcountry. And the risk of avalanche is something that certainly people need to be aware of. So to help with this safe initiative, and to help get the message out about how things can go wrong and what people need to know, a couple of individuals are lending their voice to this campaign. They were part of a group that was caught in an avalanche in British Columbia in 2016. A situation that took the life of Doug Churchill. Well, joining us on the line this afternoon to talk more about it are two of those who were directly impacted by this situation. Sheila Churchill is the widow of Doug Churchill. She joins us on the line here this afternoon. Hi there, Sheila. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Rob, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk about our Backcountry Safe initiative.
Yeah, and also joining us this afternoon is Mitch Putnam, who was also a survivor of this avalanche and is lending his voice to this campaign. Mitch, good to have you with us here as well. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having us.
So, look, obviously, this is something that had an incredible impact on your lives, and obviously, you know, especially for you, Sheila, but the importance of you know, sharing your experience and letting others learn from what happened here. Why was it important to you? And we'll ask you first, Sheila, to be a part of this and to speak about what happened 4 years ago.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, you know, 10 members of our ski trip group were engulfed by an avalanche, and that there were multiple serious injuries with 5 full burials and 5 partial burials. And although every one of us was quickly unburied in 10 minutes, my husband, Doug, died of critical injuries 3 days after in the ICU. And for me, grief has been a very private journey, but we have chosen to go public right now to share our story and the lessons we have learned from this avalanche. And our goal with Backcountry Safe is just a simple one, to raise awareness about safety in the backcountry through the lessons that we have learned.
Yeah. Mitch, your thoughts?
Yeah, definitely. I concur with that. And on our website, we do, a pretty fair job of outlining our story through video and written content that really also extends to all the lessons, as Sheila said. As we look back, we learned so much of what we could have done differently. And I think it's very applicable to any group heading out to the backcountry in the future, that whether you're guided or not guided, there's a lot of considerations you need to take in before you head out there.
Yeah, and let's talk about that, Sheila, because, I mean, obviously, you know, the trauma of what you went through, the grief that followed, and then, you know, to ask those questions and look back and think about, you know, what could we have done differently, or what do I wish that I had known? And that's going to be a difficult process too. But that's where, you know, this can be a lesson to others. So let me ask both of you, but Sheila first. I mean, when you look back then, and what are the aspects of the story that you think people really need to know about?
Well, you know, we have broken down our lessons into 5 themes. So last week we focused on know yourself, know your group. This week we're focusing on know your guide. Next week we're going to be plan your day. But regardless of which theme you look at, or whether you hire a guide or not, I think the 3 most critical takeaways that we have learned is educate, plan, and communicate. And understand that the critical importance of group dynamics and the human factor when you're out together in the backcountry.
Yeah, Mitch, expand on that. So let's talk about, you know, where these lessons apply here, and what people need to draw from your own experience.
Yeah, I think it really starts with your pre-trip planning, and even the morning of. There's great resources to access. The Avalanche Canada website is a phenomenal resource for getting some up-to-date avalanche ratings and snowpack analysis, and, you know, you need good weather forecasting, and then just observations throughout the region from other people contributing, and guides and so forth. So you can gather a lot of information before you even start your trip, and then the day of, you need to do some analysis as you are moving through avalanche terrain, and you need to be prepared to change your route path and decision making based on what you're seeing and how the group's doing. And Sheila touched on it. The human factor is a big deal, and I think a lot of experts are starting to recognize this as a major contributor to incidents in the backcountry, and it is that group dynamic where you have various personalities and different levels of fitness and tolerance for risk and things like this. And you, at the end of the day, you just need to be communicating. And I think the bigger the group, potentially the bigger the issue with that. And then if you have a guide like we did that day, that's another interesting dynamic that you need to deal with. And the human factors are a big one. And then once you're out there, you need to manage your group. And in our situation, we did a really poor job of managing our group on an exposed avalanche slope. And we had basically, as Sheila said, there's 10 people, almost 12 out of 13 that were engulfed in this avalanche. And that should never happen. I mean, we all accept a certain level of risk when we go to the backcountry, but you manage that as best you can and make conservative decisions. And worst case, you might have one or two people in a large group exposed at one time and not the majority of your group. So that's kind of a sampling of some of the things that, you know, we took away from our experience.
Yeah. And Sheila, the point about a guide, I mean, it's an important component of this kind of a journey, but at the same time, maybe it's one of the aspects where, you know, there can become that people can be lulled into a sense of security that, okay, we have a guide, so everything's taken care of, right?
Yeah, and I totally agree. I am the perfect example. I had abdicated my personal responsibility to the guide, and it was incumbent upon me to ask more questions. As Mitch had said, you know, take some avalanche training courses, avalanche skills training, AST 1 or 2 or first aid. We all had some degree of avalanche training, but we didn't apply it for ourselves personally. There was an expectation that the guide would make the decisions for our group. So, you know, whether you're with a guide or whether you're just with a group of friends, talk to each other and connect throughout the entire day. Is everybody comfortable? You know, are we on the right slope for the conditions? And, you know, be comfortable to speak up and state when you're not feeling safe, and make sure you check in with everybody else in the group too, whether it's the guide or your group members. You need to communicate.
Yeah, and that's the thing, Mitch, and I think this whole campaign is about, you know, finding that balance, because, you know, there's the danger of complacency, obviously, the danger of thinking it's not going to happen to me, or the danger of thinking that someone's got it looked after, but it's not about going the extreme other way and saying, you know, it's too dangerous, don't go to the backcountry, right? It's certainly, it can be enjoyable, it can be safe, it can be fun, but it's about being equipped with knowledge, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And, you know, I think of our day. It was a beautiful bluebird day and a lot of smiles within our group. It was very enjoyable. We had done the day before, this was a week-long trip, and the day before we had done a couple of easy low-profile runs just to get our legs going. And so, yeah, we were in a different space. You know, our age group was in the 50s and 60s. We weren't young thrill seekers, if that's a fair I guess, but then all of a sudden we found ourselves on this, you know, steep, exposed, long chute, and before we knew it, we were in a real tragedy, and there are consequences that hit you so quickly. Like, we had, obviously, the worst case, we lost Doug, but we also had multiple injuries within our group, and some of them are lifelong lasting, and so yeah, there's certainly consequences, and you can get lured into as you say, a sense of complacency.
All right, well, again, the website is backcountrysafe.ca, and if folks are thinking about heading out into the backcountry at some point during the winter, certainly go there first, and there's some great tips and advice and more on your own story, backcountrysafe.ca. Sheila, Mitch, again, thanks so much for joining us here today. I really do appreciate this.
Well, thanks very much, Rob. I appreciate you giving us a call and helping us spread the message, you know, get people to our backcountrysafe.ca website, and stay safe out there this winter.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. Rob. All the best to you both.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, take care. All right, so there you go. That's Sheila Churchill and Mitch Putnam, who are two of the survivors from this avalanche incident back in 2016, the group of 10. Various injuries, as he said, just quite, a very traumatic experience to go through that. And then obviously the grief of losing a friend and Sheila losing her husband, Doug Churchill, who died in that avalanche. I'm sure this is difficult to talk about, and I'm sure it's also difficult, and, you know, to kind of reconcile that, right, where you're still sort of beating yourself up over all these years. Should I have done this? Should I have done that? Should I have, you know, taken that bad feeling I had in my gut more seriously? But, you know, in the hopes, though, that others can learn from what they went through, so that we can ensure that the folks are able to safely use the backcountry. This isn't a message of it's dangerous, stay home. This is a message of saying, look, it can be enjoyable. It can be a lot of fun. It's a great winter getaway. But you got to know what you're getting into. Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Rob Breckenridge. You can email me, rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.
Afternoons with Rob Breckenridge, starting at 12:30 on News Talk 770 Calgary.